I'm Ron Seggi, and for almost 26 years now, we have originated our internationally syndicated radio show from the beautiful city of Orlando, Florida, a city known for its fun parks, cultural centers, and tourist attractions, a city that is the number one destination for visitors year after year. This past weekend, a dark shadow was cast over the city beautiful with the nation's most tragic mass shooting in our country's history. Our hearts are broken and our sadness runs deep, but our spirit will persevere. This tragedy has made a indelible impact not only to its residents, but to millions of people around the globe who find the despicable actions of those who have no regard for human life destroy those who do. We are proud of our city and hope that you will join us in helping to rebuild the pain that we feel. Orlando has always been strong, but now dedicated to a renewed strength. We need the citizens of the world to help by keeping the victims, their families, and the citizens of Orlando in your prayers. Orlando, Florida belongs to the world, and the world should never forget or forgive what has happened here. And we are back live with Ron Seggi today on this Father's Day weekend. On our show the next 2 hours, our first guest will be actor David Duchovny. Then baseball-turned-singing star Mike Studd will be here from Lost History and Decoded, Brad Melzer. And six-time golf champion Jim Furyk will be joining us on the show. Next hour, one of the stars of London Has Fallen, actor Robert Forrester, actor Hill Harper, and we have Bill Nye, the science guy, going to be telling us the ExploraVision winners in Washington, D.C. this year, and pro surfer whose movie Soul Surfer became a story of her life, Bethany Hamilton. And that's all coming up the next 2 hours right here with Ron Seggi today. And joining us right now is our first guest. He is one prolific actor, and he is one of these individuals who are the full package. His show is going to premiere its second season, Aquarius, which airs regularly Thursdays at 10 o'clock on NBC. Joining us right now is multiple award-winning actor David Duchovny. Hi, David. How are you?
Hi. Hi. I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you being here. First of all, congratulations on season number 2. That had to be like making a motion picture.
It is. I think it's a real interesting way to relaunch the show and to give viewers a chance to go deeply into our season. And I think it suits our show because we're not the type of cop show that wraps up cases every night, every week. You know, it's not a Law and Order show where you see the crime and by the end of the show they got the bad guys behind bars. Mm-hmm. We really are a full season of multiple storylines and multiple cases that are all going to kind of coincide with the infamous Manson murders of August 69.
You know what amazes me is that how you put a fresh twist on a story that is several decades old. I mean, they call it a work of historical fiction, and I think that really describes it perfectly.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about our approach is that even though it is historical, partly, you know, based on historical and true events, when you look at what was happening in the late 60s and all the social movements that were gaining steam at that point with Black Panther movement in L.A., gay rights, women's rights, Chicano rights, all of these kind of in Southern California at that time, you know, these issues are still as relevant today as they were then. And even though we're a period show or even though we're dealing with things that happened 40, 50 years ago, I think it's really a fresh take to go back and look at our world, which really our modern world in many ways started in the late 60s, our modern political world.
Right, right.
Started in the late 60s. So it's really interesting to go back and look at what might have been.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I admire the way that you guys do this. But, you know, the reality of it is, on another plane, it's somewhat depressing to think that we, after all these years, haven't come that far, really.
Well, I think we have come far. I think change works very slowly. You know, I think one of the things about the 60s that was exciting was it felt like a revolution. You know, it felt like things were going to happen quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
And it felt... I think the reality is that it's more like a pendulum where things swing back and forth. But I think if you look at the trend, even though I'm certainly not happy where we are on many of these issues, they get better and better. They get more human. They get more humanistic. They get more tolerant. Certainly not as fast as we all want them to be, but I think things are getting better.
How much fun is it to do a show that is in a time period? I guess I'm one of the people from the 60s. I'm a student of the 60s. Yeah. And I would think that, boy, it would be great, you know, kind of being responsible for the cars and the clothes and the music of a production like that, you know, because it's my era.
Yeah. That's fun. You know, obviously that's not something that I'm involved in choosing the cars or, you know, I guess I have some say in the clothes and in my look, how I want my hairstyle. These were all things we talked about when we were creating the character and creating the show in the beginning. But what's really fascinating to me is to take take this character, Sam Hodiak, who's in the 60s, and we all know what the 60s are, like we've been talking about. It was a time of great upheaval and revolution, social revolutions. He's not of that time. He's not a hippie. He's not even a hip cop.
Yeah.
He's like a Joe Friday. He's a guy that was raised in the 20s and 30s. He served in World War II.
Right.
So what I found very interesting was to really take this fish out of water, you know, this man out of time. And he's really trying hard to save a world that has already passed them by in many ways, and that's an interesting thing to play.
That's how I feel today.
That's how I feel every day.
The world's passing me by. And a great name, Aquarius, too. I didn't realize that you went to Princeton University, received a master's degree in English from Yale, and was on the road to earning a PhD. How did you go from that into acting? And thank God you did, because you've given us millions of hours of great entertainment.
Well, thanks. It was really through writing. I was in those schools. I was really working in an academic discipline, looking forward to teaching at the college level, getting my PhD and getting a job at a college. But I also wanted to write creatively, or I wanted to write fictionally, and I cycled through all the different forms that might take, from poetry to fiction. I have gotten back to fiction writing recently. In fact, I've got a book out now, which is another period piece in 1978. I don't know if you remember who Bucky Dent was.
Yes, sure do. But absolutely.
It's a novel set in 78. And it's at the time when I was in graduate school, I guess I decided on playwriting as the most collaborative of the art forms that I could write in, the least lonely. I thought I couldn't see myself. I was 23. I couldn't see myself just sitting in a room alone writing for the rest of my life. And I thought if I write plays, then at least I'll be collaborating. I'll be outside.
Sure.
Then I just thought, well, if I'm going to write plays, I should know something about acting. So it was really kind of backwards that I got to acting.
Your first novel, Holy Cow. Tell us about the studio album that you're doing for Think Say Records.
The album came out last year called Hell or High Water. And just 12 original songs, and just came back from a tour of Europe, which was successful, and just batting around new songs right now to try and make a second album in the next few months or so.
I failed to mention in the introduction, I did say you were, you know, the full package, but Emmys, Golden Globes, Screen Actors Award Guilds, Television Critic Awards, on television, on the screen, on the stage, and the fact that you were nominated so many times and won so many times for so many things, and probably one of the only actors to have won Golden Globes as a lead for both television drama and comedy. That's versatility that is very, very seldom seen in this craft. And between the music and the writing and the acting, I mean, there's not a dimension of this business that you haven't been in.
Well, I'm hanging on. You know, I've been at it a while, and I still keep taking my swings. So, yeah, I just try to stay open and keep creative, really.
Yeah, and I left out the fact that you also have directed a lot of things, too. So,
yeah.
I mean, is there anything that you haven't done yet, David, that you want to do other than the show?
No, not really. I'd love to direct another film or two. I'm happy with the last couple of years being able to do some music and being able to write novels. I'm very happy to continue with those things. There's nothing else that I can think of that I can do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd do it if I could, but I can't draw.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's still early in the game, Dave. You know, here's what I want to do. If you, with a busy schedule, I almost feel ashamed to ask you this, okay? But you need to come back one day, and let's just talk about the music and play some of the cuts from the CD.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Because
are you kidding?
I'm a musician.
I would love to do that.
I'm a musician. I'm a singer. And, you know, this is a love of mine, and we can talk about it and have some good times with it and play some of the cuts.
I would love to talk about music with a musician. That's the best. And the truth is that the music has, you know, when I do a television show like Aquarius, there's a lot of money behind it. The music for me and the novels, to a certain extent, they're small. They're like mom and pop businesses. So if I get a chance to talk about, have an intelligent discussion about those things, I really feel grateful to be able to do it.
Well, let's do it, okay? Because it's a universal language that I love. Season 2 premiere of Aquarius, returning Thursdays at 10 o'clock on NBC, and its star is our guest, David Duchovny. Hey, David, thank you so much. This has been great, and I look forward to having you back, my friend.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon about music.
Let's do it, okay? It's a date.
Okay.
David Duchovny, what a nice guy. And I got to tell you, I'm a talented man. Truly a talented man in all aspects of the entertainment business. And stick around, because we've just begun. There's more to come with Ron Segi Today. All across the USA and around the world, it's Ron Segi Today. You talk about a unique story. We have one for you right now. And we're going to also talk about the fact that his series premiere of This Is Mike Studd is coming up this Tuesday, June 21st at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Esquire Network. Joining us right now is rap sensation none other than Mike Studd. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, and I was watching some of the clips from the show, and man, I tell you, I mean, you got a great program that's going to be hitting the airwaves, but you know what? Tell us the story. This is the fascinating part, how you went to Duke, educated there, and a former All-American baseball player who unfortunately had an injury and decided that, well, you know, I got to do something in life, and became a music sensation. Tell us about that, Mike. That's great.
Yeah. I wish I could say I planned it out like this. I can't take any credit. It really was, it really is. It's like still feels like, you know, it was such a long shot. You know, I can't even express how much of a long shot this whole thing is that I'm even, you know, in this position now. But really the story was, you know, I went to Duke, and I had a really great freshman year. That was really the year that I, you know, got all those accolades and all American stuff. That was, you know, my true freshman year. But, you know, in the same breath, as unbelievable as that was, you know, as I look back, that was the only year. That was my final year, like, pitching healthy. You know, I really ran into a ton of arm trouble and ended up having Tommy John and almost had to get it again. You know, just had a really tough go with the rehab.
Yeah.
But, you know, with that time spent off the field, I had a lot of more free time on my hands. And I started to dabble, for whatever reason, I started to dabble with music, you know, on a very basic, you know, I'm talking GarageBand on everyone's MacBook, like anyone can make it, you know. And I made a song while I was at school that just caught fire with the college network. You know what I mean? Really, what happened was that they started to play it at the bars at school, and then it got on the internet, and then it started acquiring, like, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 100,000, you know, YouTube hits. And I didn't even have a Twitter or a fan base or even a real rap name at that point. You know, I didn't even know. I had no idea what I was doing. So really, you know, that was about 5 years ago, and it's been a really steady climb, just constantly trying to evolve and grow. You know what I mean? But the cool part about what we're doing is it's really unorthodox, and that's why we have a show. You know, because we're doing it independently. We're kind of managing. It's all my friends or my employees, and we kind of self-manage the business and what we do and our decisions, and it makes for a cool situation. I feel like that's kind of part of the reason why this show is happening. You know, I'm not a mainstream name by any means. I think, you know, the reason they're taking a chance on the show is because, you know, the circumstances are pretty unique.
Was that first song that you created, was that College Humor, that back in 2000?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Well, let me tell you the reason why I really admire what you're doing. First of all, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, you had no musical background prior to this, right? I mean, you were an athlete.
Yeah, no, I'm talking none. Like, none. I never took an instrument class or sang or did anything.
Okay, now this is the reason why I'm in awe of what you're doing, all right? I've been in the entertainment business, not only broadcasting, but as a singer, because I go out and tour with an orchestra myself. I just finished one.
Awesome.
And the thing about it is that when you don't have a label, when you don't have a manager, when you are independent, when you are not with the William Morris Agency, this is an enormously difficult job. What you're doing is in self-promoting, self-concerts, all, you know, self-recording, all this stuff is so admirable. And you know what? In this day and age, with all of the social media, it's the right way to go, because if you were with a big label right now, and of course there are no big labels right now, they'd put you on a shelf someplace, and by the time that, you know, it was time to take that off the shelf, you'd be playing baseball again, you know what I'm saying?
You're exactly right. You know what you're talking about, because that's really, you know, it's part of the, you know, the undertone. I'm not really looking to give it up right now either. It's just, it's one of those things where the industry has kind of been turned upside down by the social media and how, you know, Spotify and streaming, and it's just it's a weird time in the industry, and I know for a fact I haven't met with the right label yet, because they don't really understand what we're doing exactly, and I don't fault them for it. You know, I kind of have our whole thing is just unique. It has a weird, you know, it has a different vibe, you know, than what the normal hip-hop artist is, or even what the normal pop singer is, you know. So we're just kind of like rocking and rolling on our own terms. I think the kids, my supporters, like, really, you know, they go out of their way to support, because they know that we're doing it on our own. And, you know, the way we've gotten so big is just by going out on the road and touring. We've just been road warriors, and it really did build, you know, it built up. That's how, you know, a big part of why we're here is our touring. You know, our touring is big, and you'll see it, you know, if you tune into the show. We, you know, it's gotten to a point where it's turning heads, and it's, this was a cool opportunity for me to put, you know, to put that on a pedestal and get to show the world, you know, how we're doing on the road. So it's a really cool opportunity, the whole thing.
Debut studio album, Relief, debuted at 109 on the Billboard 200 chart, peaked at 55, all right? Number one on Billboard's rap charts in 2014 with the second album, I think it was Closer. And you surpassed over 135,000 subscribers on your YouTube channel. Now, this is the reason why I think what you're doing is cool. When you walk into a studio, you're self-financing that, I assume, right, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So there's no monkeying around. I mean, it's all business, because every minute you lose is another dollar and a half.
You're exactly right. You know, a big part of what I did and how I was able to get here on a college kid's, you know, broke pockets pretty much in the beginning was, I acquired these guys, like some of them I grew up with, some of them I just, you know, encountered at the very beginning of my career, and we ended up like forming a collective. So they're my employees, they're my friends, we all live under the same roof, they all have a role. One of them's a video guy, one of them records my music, and one of them takes the pictures and does the websites, and the other one tour manages. And it's really a cool thing that we've kind of put together, and it really didn't, it wasn't, I wish I could take credit and say like we had this plan. It really kind of all fell into place for us this last year or so. Yeah, everyone kind of hit the ground running, and we're actually, you know, kind of picking up steam. So this show is like a really kind of hitting in an exciting time in my career.
Well,
I'm excited.
I'm glad for you. Everybody's got skin in the game. What is your website, Mike?
It's if you're going to go check out my tour dates, it will be www.mikestud.com.
Super.
So, we're going to launch that and pair it with the, you know, with the show airing. So,
and the show premieres now, everybody. This is Mike Studd on Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Esquire Network. Hey, Mike, you got to do me a favor now. I mean, you weren't up there getting Grammy Awards. Don't forget us, okay? Come back on the show, okay, my friend?
I hope so. I hope I get there one day. I won't forget. I appreciate your time.
Mike, good luck.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mike. Mike Studd has been our guest, a remarkable young man who's doing something in the music business that I just love. He's doing it on his own. And his show premieres at 10 o'clock on the Esquire Network. And there's more to come with Ron Segi today. If it's trending, it's right here on Ron Segi Today. I'm very excited to have our next guest with us, because he's been a friend of our show for many, many years. The host of Lost History on H2 and Brad Meltzer's Decoded on the History Channel. Got a new book out. It's out right now. Came out the 7th of this month. Joining us is our friend Brad Meltzer. Hey, Brad, how you doing?
Always good to be back, sir.
Thank you so much for joining us. I have to admit, candidly, and you know this, I love what you do because you make television interesting again.
I appreciate it. And listen, it's just, as you know, you're a history lover as I am, there's no story like the true story.
Right.
And, you know, we all have the Library of Alexandria in our pockets today, but trying to find the truth on Google is an impossibility. So right. I love that we get to share these stories of George Washington, of Benedict Arnold, and all these amazing things that really did happen.
Well, let's start with that story, okay? Because I find that fascinating. Here we have a situation where the father of our country, he's going to go visit Benedict Arnold at his home. When Benedict Arnold finds out he's coming, he leaves. He leaves not only his house, he leaves his wife, he leaves his child, and he defects to the British. Then Washington, who is so devastated by this, is the first time that they actually saw him in tears. But then it became very, very unusual with what was requested by Benedict Arnold to George Washington, which Washington adhered to. Tell us that.
Yeah, it's their moments together in the end are some of the most heartbreaking in U.S. history, and not just because, as you mentioned, George Washington is seen crying, but a letter comes from Benedict Arnold to George Washington. The letter asks for three things. It says, one, please don't kill my wife. She didn't know I was a traitor. Two, don't kill the staff. They didn't know I was a traitor either. I did this myself. And three, in one of the craziest moments, Ron, of letter-writing history, George Washington reads these words. He's basically, Benedict Arnold says, can you please send me back my belongings and my clothing? He wants his stuff back. The guy just put a knife in the back of George Washington, and he wants his stuff. And amazingly, George Washington sends it. But here's what gets to me, is that to this day, nobody knows what is in that baggage that George Washington sends back to Benedict Arnold. And I don't want to ruin Chapter 85 of The House of Secrets, the thriller where we talk about it, but you're going to see my theory in there.
Okay, and The House of Secrets, by the way, is the name of the book that came out the 7th of this month. How does this relate to this television show conspiracy? And, you know, I know you use fictional characters here. I remember the incident of this happening. I just can't think of the TV show's host name, and I know that you don't want to divulge that. But tell us a little bit about this story with Hazel Nash, a fictional character.
Yeah, so The House of Secrets as a thriller, as a mystery, opens up where this woman wakes up in a hospital, and she has no memory. And she's told that there's been an accident that's killed her father, who is the host of a conspiracy TV show, just like the one that I host for the History Channel, Decoded. From there, the FBI tells her that the last person her father was seen with was also found dead. And there was an object stuffed into his body, a priceless book that belonged to Benedict Arnold. And we quickly hear the story about Benedict Arnold and George Washington. From there, she has memories all messed up. She goes home. She finds things in her house and poison. She doesn't know how they got there. She finds scars on her body she can't recall. And only by solving this murder can she figure out what happened to her father and also who she really is. She's the mystery of this book. And she is full of secrets. So as the book opens up, what it allows me to do is she's solving this mystery, but you get to see the story of what happened with Benedict Arnold. You get to see her father's life. And, you know me a long time now. People tell me their secrets.
Yeah, yes.
They just do. And I know why. You know, I've had Bill Clinton write me a letter. I've had George and Barbara Bush invite me to go to Texas to spend time with them. I've had the Department of Homeland Security ask me to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And I know why, because I write those thrillers people like, or at least that's why the Bushes invited me out there. And I a couple of years ago, I had a lunch at the White House. I got to walk in and out of the White House. No one looked twice at me. Why? Because I'm that guy who writes those thrillers. I love that I get to do that. But what I realized, Ron, is that I'm the perfect spy. I'm the perfect one to secretly work for the government because no one looks twice at me. And so the main character of this book does host a conspiracy TV show just like Decoded that I host on the History Channel, and you'll have to decide for yourself what exactly is he doing with the U.S. government, and I didn't make it up. That's my life that I pulled it from.
Well, and you might as well count me on the list too, because I told you one time that I would tell you some backstories of Elvis, and you were going to do a story on it.
Oh, trust me, if Lost History was still around, that is one of the top ones on my list. I still have it written down. happened, you know, we wanted to do it for Lost History for season two. The problem was that Lost History did so well for the History Channel for H2. The problem was is that channel itself, H2, got rebranded to the Vice Network. So we never got our season two that was on our list to do, which I would kill to do that one.
The need to be in syndication now is absolutely at the top of your list. It's got to be that way so that nobody can touch you when they change the policies of the network or the distributors. But, you know, you talk about the Department of Homeland Security asking you to brainstorm some different ways terrorists attack the United States. This is a program called the Red Cell Program. How does that work, Brad?
Yeah, you know, they asked me to come in, as you said, to brainstorm different things, and I was blown away by that. And what they would do is pair me with a Secret Service agent and with a chemist. They would give us a target. It might be some big fun event that everyone loves in the United States, and they would say, go destroy it. I would come up with my crazy way in, and the Secret Service guy would say, hey, here's a better way to get inside with less security. And the chemist would say, let's use this chemical. It'll dissipate less quickly in the air. And by the time we were done, within an hour, we'd have destroyed this place. And you don't go home feeling good. You go home terrified. But I use those things like that are, to me, what drive the book. So one of my favorite stories in there, and this is a real story, you know, just to talk about how the government gets information, I was asking them, besides Red Cell and things I've done, how else does the government get good intelligence? I asked a military intelligence officer, and he told me, Ron, this true story, that there was years ago a dictator who hated the United States. And this dictator, what no one knew, is that through one of his top lieutenants, was secretly helping the United States, secretly working with us as a spy for us, mm-hmm. for America.
Right.
And the reason he was doing it was the most logical reason of all, for family. His lieutenant had a sick child who needed the kind of medical care that only the United States could offer. So we gave the child some medical care. In return, we got information on weapons and kept them out of the hands of terrorists. And again, you'll see it in the pages of the House of Secrets, but I didn't make it up. It happened in real life.
A very similar storyline appeared on Madam Secretary, you know, so you can see how these things really run parallel and true. I mean, they're not made up, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, and listen, a good idea is a living, breathing thing. We all know there's nothing more powerful than an idea. You know, someone said to me, if you don't write your idea, someone else will write it. So it's no surprise to me that there's another book about Benedict Arnold right now that you'll see this on Madam. I mean, it's, and I think the reason it is, and it's worth discussing, is that, you know, we used to think the good guy was the good guy and the bad guy was the bad guy. And what we're seeing now, present, you know, day's events excluded, but every once in a while you see the extreme of who's good and who's bad. But for the most part, in all of our lives, you know, is Benedict Arnold a good guy or a bad guy? He was a decorated officer, risked his life to help this fledgling United States, did something certainly awful, did bad things, but is he good, is he bad, or is he just complicated? And that's what we wanted with Hazel, the hero in our new thriller. You know, she's finding her old life that she wasn't a good person. You know, she reads her memories and she's like, wait, I don't think I was a good soul. But is she good? Is she bad? Or is she just like the rest of us, all complicated? And I think that's what we all are.
You know, I give you a lot of credit, too, Brad, for your perseverance, because I know that you receive, as I did with you, several requests or letters that are, frankly, have no basis for it at all. 98% of the letters that you receive, I understand, have no real value. They're baseless. 2% are right on the money. To be able to ascertain the 2% out of the 100%, I think, takes an enormous amount of patience and perseverance.
Listen, people are going to write me stories. They're going to bring me stuff. I had a guy who brought me the Holy Grail, he said, to one of my book signings, right? The book signings I do are fun for that reason, because people just bring the craziest things. You know the good ones when you see them. Abraham Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes Booth. We all know the story. And every history book will tell you that 12 days after Abraham Lincoln was shot, John Wilkes Booth was shot himself and killed. And I get contacted by the family of John Wilkes Booth, the killer of Abraham Lincoln. And they contact me through their lawyer, and they say, listen, every history book has it wrong. They actually shot the wrong guy. Our relative John Wilkes Booth escaped. It was a family secret, and we have the proof. Would you like to hear it? And, man, you know right there that's a story you need to hear. So the character in the House of Secrets, you know, it does exactly that. He has the benefit of what I have in my life, which is people telling him these great stories. And sometimes, you know, as we all know, you can just get someone who's telling you a real one.
The name of the book is House of Secrets. It is out right now. It just came out the 7th of this month. You got to get it. And, Brad, you got to do me a favor.
Yeah.
You got to come back and join us anytime you want, even if you're sitting around the house one day and say, I have absolutely nothing to do. Let me know.
If I didn't realize how close you were to where I was in Winter Park, I would have, moved heaven and earth to try and get to you.
Brad, it's always good talking with you, and congratulations on the new book, and I urge everyone to go out and get it. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Our guest has been Brad Meltzer and the brand new book that is out right now, House of Secrets. And there's more to come with Ron Segi today. We're live all across the USA and around the world with Ron Segi today. If it's trending, it's right here. I'm really excited to have our next guest with us because he is a champ, six-time golf tournament champion, member of 15 consecutive U.S. national teams, fourth on the all-time career earnings list, and the sixth player in the history to join the 59 Club. Joining us right now is top pro golfer Jim Furyk. Hey, Jim, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing great, Ron. How are you?
I'm doing good. So nice to have you here. Jim, first of all, before we get into what we want to talk about today, I have to ask you, you know, how do you guys stay so calm when you got so many people watching you? I haven't golfed in a long time, even though I live on a golf course. But, you know, even when I'm at the clubhouse and it's ready for me to tee off and I see a few people watching, I choke. How do you get around that? I mean, is there a mindset that you have that says nobody's looking when you know that there is a bazillion people looking?
Well, I knew that if the folks that were watching from the outside of the ropes were that good, they'd be on the inside of the ropes with me. So I'm not really worried about it. But, you know, if you put me on the microphone and made me talk for 3 hours on a show, I'd probably choke myself. So I think it's what you're trained for and what you've worked hard to do, and I think the preparation is what makes it easier.
And you're getting ready, of course, for a tournament that's coming up. Now, Jim, I understand that your father, by the way, his name is Mike Furyk, your dad was your only coach. Is that true?
That is true. He's been my coach since I was a kid, and still to this day, as a 46-year-old, my dad has been my only coach I've known on tour, so this is kind of my chance to coach my coach, who is my father. So I've partnered with Pfizer, and we have an initiative right now to talk to folks about adult vaccinations and specifically for pneumococcal pneumonia. For folks that are age 65 and older, they're at an increased risk for pneumococcal pneumonia. And what they can do is go to a website, which is called knowpneumonia.com. It's knowpneumonia.com. But more importantly, to talk to their doctor and talk about the importance of adult vaccinations. So, and what's important about this is my parents are healthy. It's important for those folks out there to know that even healthy individuals, 65 and older, are at an increased risk. And it's important for them to talk to their doctor as well and be proactive rather than reactive.
Now, when people think of vaccinations, immediately what comes to mind is a small child. So this is kind
Absolutely.
Of at the other end of the spectrum. Now, when you talk about pneumococcal pneumonia, there is a lot on television about pneumococcal pneumonia. Now, I don't mean to sound uneducated, but I'm going to be honest with you. What is pneumococcal pneumonia?
Well, it's the most common type of bacterial pneumonia. So it's an infectious disease. And at its most serious, it's life-threatening. So, and those folks, again, that are at an increased risk are adults over the age of 65. So that's really who we're talking to. We're talking to folks my age with parents that are 65 and older. We're talking to your listeners that are 65 and older. It's important for them to, they can go to the website, they can see it, at what risk they have, but, you know, importantly, go talk to their doctor.
How do they contract it, though? I mean, is it a virus?
It's bacterial. It's bacterial, so it's an infectious disease.
So it's something that isn't obviously hereditary. I mean, it's something that is contracted later in life because of exposure to something.
Well, that is correct. And, I'm not a doctor, and so I don't want to put anything out there that's incorrect, but it is an infectious disease. And for those folks that want to learn more, we suggest you go to our website, which is knowpneumonia.com.
Okay. Now, you mentioned about your dad being a coach. My background is in broadcasting and music. And when I was growing up, they always told me never take music lessons from your brother, your mother, your father, whatever the case may be, because there's not that division between the authority and, you know, I'm going to get away with this. Okay. What about in your case? I mean, would it have been a different scenario if somebody else told you how to get that swing that you're famous for? Or was it better that your father did?
I wish we were on TV instead of the radio so you could see the big smile on my face. I was actually laughing through the never take lessons from a family member comment because it's difficult. When you love someone so much, I think it's harder probably for the parent to be the coach because they'll be tougher on their child. It's also harder for the child because you probably don't respect the authority as much. And I think my dad and I had to work through that at an early age, and it wasn't as much him as it was me. I think, I probably lashed back or said things to my father as a pupil that I would have never said to another adult or a teacher, but you feel like you can get away with it because you're the son.
That's right.
When I was a kid, I thought that some of our battles that we had, which we had a few when I was real young, I thought they were mostly my dad's fault. And then as I got older, I thought it was 50-50. And now that I have my own children, I realize it was all my fault.
Well, yeah.
I think we got over that pretty quickly. And it's really been a wonderful relationship. It's been a way that I've spent a lot of time with my father that I wouldn't have normally. And I really feel like when I'm out there walking the fairways, when I'm playing, when I've won events, I feel like my father's been with me every step of the way.
Now, does he still coach you now?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How does he feel about coaching a champ now? I mean, is he a little intimidated?
Well, there's a lot of pressure, I think, on my dad. I'm not sure he would say it, but I have a very unusual, unorthodox-looking swing. And my dad realized from an early age that I wasn't very mechanically inclined. So he was wise enough to teach me through feel and realize that I wasn't going to be able to break down. My swing is kind of like my fingerprint. I wasn't going to be able to break down that swing and totally change it and then rely on it under pressure.
Yeah.
And I think why my swing has been successful and why it's worked is it's natural to me. So when, as you mentioned, when people are watching, when the heat is on, I can trust it because it's natural. It's innate to me.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. Is he the reason? Did he come up with the name The Grinder?
No. And, no one really calls me The Grinder. I think that was a nickname that was given through the media. It was written in an article. Some folks have run with it, and now I hear it all the time, but no one would walk by the locker room and call me The Grinder on the way by. And I guess some folks are worried that I might be offended by it, that, I kind of take it as a compliment that, I was able to get a lot out of my career, and I worked hard for it, and I take that as a compliment.
Well, great. Well, Jim, first of all, congratulations on, and good luck, I should say, to the Oakmont. And again, where can we go for more information about what we're talking about today? Vaccines, especially for pneumococcal pneumonia for the over 65 crowd. I won't say the elderly, the over 65 crowd.
65 and older is at the increased risk. It's knowpneumonia.com, but that's knowpneumonia.com. And also, we suggest you go out there and talk to your physician.
Great. Jim, anytime you need a caddy, let me know. I'm great on the golf cart.
You think you're on the golf cart? Okay.
I'll be the driver.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. Our special guest has been professional golfer Jim Furyk. I tell you something, he's a terrific talent. 16-time golf tournament champion who at 46 years old still has his father as his only coach. And there's more to come live all across the USA and around the world with Ron Segi today. That wraps up hour number one of Ron Segi Today. I want to thank my guests this first hour for being part of the show, and they include actor David Duchovny, baseball-turned-singing star Mike Studd, from Lost History Brad Meltzer, and 16-time golf champion Jim Furyk. Next hour, London Has Fallen is the movie. The actor will be Robert Forrester on the show. Another actor, Hill Harper. Then we have Bill Nye, the science guy, and pro surfer whose movie Soul Surfer became part of her life. It was her life, Bethany Hamilton. And that's all coming up next hour, live all across the USA and around the world with Ron Segi Today. Everyone, welcome back to hour number two of Ron Segi Today on this Father's Day weekend. And on our show this second hour, we have actor Robert Forrester, who is one of the stars of London Has Fallen, which is out on DVD right now. Great actor. He's done a lot of things in his life. And speaking about great actors, we also have Hill Harper joining us on the show. An old friend of the program, Bill Nye, the science guy, is going to announce the winners in Washington, D.C. at the Press Club for the ExploraVision winners. These are youngsters that have invented things that you will just not believe. And then pro surfer who lost her arm to a shark bite when she was only 13, Bethany Hamilton, who, by the way, the movie Soul Surfer is the story of her life. And that's all coming up this hour, Father's Day weekend with Ron Segi. all across the USA and around the world. If it's trending, it's right here with Ron Segi today. I'm very happy to have our next guest with us. I think in 25 years, I don't think he's ever been on the show with us. I'm a big fan of his work, though. He's a sensational actor, and we're going to be talking about something that's very exciting that's already been out on digital download. Now it's available on DVD today. Academy Award nominee, Robert Forster. Hello, Robert. How are you today?
Excellent. Thanks, Ron. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, too, my friend. And congratulations. I understand that today, London Has Fallen is now out on DVD. Of course, the sequel to Olympus Has Fallen. What a great movie to be part of. I mean, this had to be great, reprising the role of General Edward Clegg.
Yes. I started out as a private, my first movie. in Reflections in a Golden Eye, 1966.
Right.
My father, who was in the American military during World War II, came on the set, and immediately John Huston threw him in a uniform. He became a colonel. He was very pleased and proud of it, and I'd say he'd be very pleased that I have turned into a general.
Wow.
Starting from a private. So, and if he were alive today, I'm sure he would be a consumer of this movie.
You talk about your dad. He was an elephant trainer for a while, was he not?
He was on the Ringling during the 1930s.
Wow.
He became a roustabout.
Really?
He and a friend of his had been loggers. He had 10 brothers, my father.
Oh.
And they were loggers up in the Canadian woods. He said one spring after the river drive, getting the logs down to the sawmill when the river breaks up in the spring, he said that he hitchhiked to Albany, New York. He got out of the truck. He said, and the first thing he saw was Ringling paper. He said to his friend, "Let's join the circus." And, of course, the circus would not have them. But he said they trailed the show for a couple of days, and then, he said, they put him on at the end of the show in a job that usually separates anybody who is not going to last from the guys who can last. He said they gave them the job of humping Bibles. Humping Bibles? I wonder what that was, he said. And so, if you remember when the show was under canvas, they had bleacher seats.
Yes.
But they also had seats that you could buy for 10 cents that were folding chairs. And when the audience was leaving the front door, a gang of guys rushed in the back door and started tearing down the bleachers. When they got to the folding seats, the folding seats sat on two planks hinged down the middle, these two planks, and they're called Bibles.
Wow.
And they're very heavy, he said. One guy at one end and another at the other end lifted them up. And the guy he was working with, my father, said that the guy said, "Grab yourself some popcorn boxes, put them on your shoulder to cushion the weight of this thing." And he said he would hump them out, carry them out to a waiting wagon. And at the end of the job, he said, "Why do they call those Bibles?"
Yeah.
He said, the guy said, "Because these two planks hinge down the middle, because they fold up like a book, and they'll put you down on your knees."
Oh.
They call them Bibles. And so he said he and his friend, and he worked for the Ringling for the next 5 or 6 years until World War II. He said that the following year he wanted to work with the cats, but there were no openings, so he put in for the bull department, the elephant department.
Wow.
And he said he worked with elephants for the next 5 years. He was a very patient, very soft guy, my father. Never remember him ever spanking me, for instance. He only spoke to me, talked to me about things. What a guy. He's a World War II guy, and the last thing he saw was Jackie Brown. Quentin Tarantino gave me Jackie Brown, and my father, who had never lost faith in me, for almost 30 years of a career, and my career had gone up and down, this guy never lost faith in me. He said just before he died, he saw some of Jackie Brown. Quentin sent me some cut footage that I could show my father on videotape, and he said, "This is going to do you some good, Bob."
Oh, so, what a great story.
There we go.
What a great story. And my dad was the same way. He never hit me. I asked him one time, he says, "How come you don't punish me like my other friends?" He says, "You don't want me to do that. I'll just talk it through." You have a BA in psychology from Rochester. How did you get into show business? I mean, your very first role is opposite Arlene Francis. And then, as you mentioned, you worked, you know, in other things. You were a substitute teacher for a while, construction worker. Then you get a five-picture deal, and now you're back up with Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando. And, you know, your role is Jackie Brown, and the list is on and on and on. But how did you start off with psychology?
It happened on the first day of my senior year at the University of Rochester. I pulled into a car parking spot, and in front of my car walked a beautiful brunette. She was wearing a black London Fog raincoat and high heels. I was struck by lightning. I leaped out of the car. I followed the girl. I was trying to think of something to say. She walked into the auditorium. They're doing an audition for Bye Bye Birdie. I figured that's how I'm going to meet the girl. She was in the show. I auditioned for the part of the guy with the gold suit. I hadn't seen the movie and I hadn't seen the play, but I did see the trailer to the movie, and I knew it was about a guy with a gold suit,
right,
who does a parody of Elvis Presley.
Right.
And I auditioned for that part, and they didn't give it to me. They put me in the chorus, and I thought, the hell with this. I don't want to be in the chorus. But I said, stick, Bob, you'll meet the girl. I did meet the girl. I married the girl. We have three daughters. And following semester, somebody said, would you like to play the hero in a one-act Irish comedy? And that's all it took.
Wow.
I said, you know, I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be an actor. I wonder how you do it. And then one little step leads to another, and I went to New York City, and a girl asked me to do a scene with her for her class and then for an agent. And then the agent sends me out on an interview. I get the job. I'm on Broadway in 1965 in a two-character play with Arlene Francis. So it was a lot of lucky steps for me. But I had no idea how many actors there were and how few parts there were. It was a long shot that I didn't know quite what I was getting into. And ignorance was my best friend.
Sometimes that is exactly the case. Here's something I found interesting. You talked about Quentin Tarantino. When you auditioned for one of his movies that he offered you a part in, it was a 7-hour audition. What do you do for 7 hours, Robert?
First of all, we talked a lot. We talked about my old career, because my career had died by the time I ran into him. Then he got some old television show that I had done, Banyan. I had done a television show called Banyan.
Sure, I remember that.
And I had a 16-millimeter print, and we ran it in his screening room. Then we read Jackie Brown. We read the character. I changed characters. I read the Robert De Niro part, and he read all the rest of the parts. This all took time, and we blah-blahed, and we had some, I don't know, we probably had a sandwich or lunch or something. So the whole thing did take a very long time, but when I left his house, it was by then dark. He walked me out to the car. He said, you're going to make a great Max Cherry. And it was at that moment that I said, wow, this guy is going to hire me. And then it took a few more days for the lawyers to get through with it, because I know that there were other big actors who wanted the role. And I had nothing working for me. My career was dead by then. But only Quentin Tarantino stood in the way of all the agents and all the studios and everybody else who wanted that part. He said, no, this is going to be for Robert Forster. Wow, what a thrill.
Yeah,
and I was back in business.
Oh, what a sensational story. You're a great guest. You got to come back 1,000 times in the course of a year. Well, we want to mention again, the sequel to Olympus Has Fallen, which of course is the London Has Fallen, is now available on DVD starting today. Has extra footage, shows some of the unique challenges that you encounter on the set, which I love that behind-the-scenes stuff. And I congratulate you, Robert, for all of the sensational work that you've done, and of course, winning an Academy Award nomination for the role of Max Cherry in Jackie Brown, and now being part of this DVD that's out today, London Has Fallen. But you got to do me a favor. You got to come back. You're a great guest.
You're a gent. Thank you, Ron.
I urge everyone to get London Has Fallen now on DVD. Robert, I look forward to having you back, okay?
Thank you, Ron. I'd be delighted.
That sounds great. Our guest has been Academy Award nominee Robert Forster. What a talented man he is, and a nice man, too. A great, humble individual who had a very unusual beginning in the entertainment business, but has turned it into a real dynamic career. And London Has Fallen is out on DVD starting today, of which he is one of the stars, along with Morgan Freeman, Angela Bassett, I mean, a whole list of celebrities.
Thank you very much, Ron. It's a real pleasure. It was a fun interview, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Robert. That's very kind of you to say. And there's more to come live all across the USA and around the world with Ron Segi today. Live nationwide and around the world, it's Ron Segi today. I think one of the things lacking in America today is somebody out there, or a lot of people out there for that matter, who are role models. Our kids have no role models anymore, you know? Our next guest, I think, falls into that category. We need more people like him. He is, of course, a tremendous actor, and we'll run down all of his credentials as an actor with Limitless Now, but of course with CSI New York. And he does so many other things. I mean, he is a humanitarian, now as an actor, as we mentioned, author, health and wellness ambassador, educator, philanthropist. Joining us right now is our friend, Hill Harper. Hi, Hill. How are you?
Hey, Ron. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for joining us today. And I meant what I said. I mean, I look down all the things that you have done. And may I mention a few of them?
You can mention all you want. I want to hear it because it'll encourage me to do more.
Well, you know, I once made a comment to Steve Allen. I was reading all of the things that he did, and he says, stop. And I said, what's wrong? He says, sounds like an obituary. Don't go any further. Let's run down just a few. As I mentioned before, a great actor. He received 3 NAACP Image Awards for Best Lead Actor in a Drama Series, playing Dr. Sheldon Hawks, and then go on to the miniseries Mama's Flora Family with Cicely Tyson and Covert Affairs and Married with Children, where you got your start. I remember that. The Sopranos, ER, Murder One, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Spike Lee hired you to be in a feature film, Get on the Bus, and the list goes on and on and on, including a couple of books, 4 to be exact, on the New York Times bestseller list, and appointed to the position of member, President's Cancer Panel, from your classmate, a gentleman that we've heard of before, Barack Obama. Quite a list of credentials, my friend.
Yes, yes, and it's just the beginning. We're just starting out our hard work, and so I appreciate you running those down, because at the end of the day, none of those, I couldn't have achieved any of those things without help from other people, and other people helping me get to where I wanted to go, and the goals that I still have for my life, and that's what this program that I'm working with the National Honor Society represents. That's why I'm giving back in that way, because nobody can get there without somebody else saying, hey, you can do it, let me help you. And that's what the Honor Your Future Now campaign is all about.
We want to talk about that, because you are a member in good standing, if you will, with the National Honor Society. You are the son of 2 doctors, okay? Your dad was a psychiatrist, your mother an anesthesiologist, and you graduated from Brown University and then went on to graduate from Harvard Law School. Now, the point is, when they see people in school that have ambition and that are good, people kind of lean to them, all right? Because they think this gentleman, this girl has a future. And we want to run down what it's like to become a member of the National Honor Society. But what about those, Hill, that don't show that but still have it or could cultivate it somewhere down the road?
But Ron, you're so right. All of us have the capacity for greatness. I don't believe it's limited by what you've done in your past. Your future is now. That's why the campaign is called Honor Your Future Now. It doesn't matter. I don't care if you've been a straight F student, if you've been a straight A student, whatever, that's behind you. What's next is, what are you going to do now? How are you going to build a successful life? And what tools are you going to apply to make that happen? Now, there are 5 pillars of the National Honor Society, and that's scholarship, character, leadership, service, and citizenship. Only one of the 5 speaks to grades, even. Mm-hmm. So look at your life. Are you a high character person? Do you make choices and treat people in a high character, kind way? Leadership, are you a leader in your school and in your community? Service, do you give back? Citizenship, are you an active member of this great country? Are you an active, positive citizen, helping to bring and elevate your community, your school, your country? Or are you a drag on it, okay? And then there's scholarship, which, are you performing at a high level to the best of your ability, working as hard as you can, working as smart as you can in school? Because I always like to say, I would rather work smart than work hard.
Sure.
Working smart is the best way to do it. And that means having a plan. There are different ways to crack the code, so to speak. And education is a huge part of that. And that's education set me up for success. And education is the number one foundation building tool for setting anybody up for success. But it doesn't matter if you consider yourself a quote-unquote good student or a bad student, if you come from a poor family or a rich family, if you go to a good school so-called or a bad school so-called. That none of that actually matters. It actually matters, do you have a plan that you can work from where you are right now to where you want to get to? Anybody can do it. That's open to anybody.
You know, one of the stipulations that the National Honor Society has is understanding the obligations of the membership. And that could include a lot of chapter meetings and so on and so forth. Does it include, and I think you would be marvelous at it, a tour of schools and assemblies?
You know, I speak at a lot of schools. I do different talks all the time. I speak at high schools. I speak at colleges. I speak all over. And it is something that's important and part of my give back. As of right now, we don't have a National Honor Society tour set up under the Honor Your Future Now, but you never know what the future holds. So I appreciate you suggesting that. And, you know, some of the specific programs for NHS students are, one, college admission support, two, National Honor Society scholarships, the actual real money for school, three, the National Junior Honor Society Outstanding Achievement Award, which is a part of the National Junior Honor Society, which is the middle school honor society, four, scholarship search tools, so tools that are there to help search for other scholarships, you know, beyond just the National Honor Society scholarships, and five, state summits, so you get to meet other students who are members. And so that's one thing. Those are things that, five things that National Honor Society offers. But I want to be clear, to be able to go to the honoryourfuturenow.org and take advantage of all the resources that are on that site, you don't have to be a member of the National Honor Society. In fact, if you're a parent, please go to that site, because the number one person that students go to get information about higher education are parents. And so you need to educate yourself as a parent to know to give your child, give your student good advice. If you're mentoring a young person, go to honoryourfuturenow.org. If you're a student, don't just rely on your parents or the mentors. They may not know what they're talking about. You need to go to honoryourfuturenow.org. to get the real information.
This is the time of the year where students start to look at what's going to happen next summer when they, you know, start getting ready for college, but it's never too early to find out more about the National Honor Society. That website again, Hill.
It's Honor Your Future Now.
Okay.
All one word. honoryourfuturenow.org.
And for those people who think an honor student sometimes can be very intimidating because they're so bright, that's a falsehood. And Hill's proved that right. In 2014, people named Hill one of the sexiest men alive.
So yeah. And it goes to show you that just by talking to me now, Ron, you know I'm not that smart. So being an honor student is not about being smart. It's just about actually getting your work done and excelling in school.
He'll come back and join us anytime, and congratulations, and go out there and spread the word. You're the man to do it.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks so much.
Our special guest is actor and an influential individual, too, I might add, Hill Harper. And there's more to come with Ron Segi today. We're back live all across the USA and around the world. It's Ron Segi today. Every year about this time, our next guest joins us. I only wish that he would join us more often. I love when he's here. He's a fabulous guy. He's a seven-time National Emmy Award-winning host. He makes science fun. He's announcing the 2016 Toshiba ExploraVision winners at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Joining us is our friend, Bill Nye, the science guy. Hey, Bill, how you doing? Nice to have you back, my friend.
Hi, Ron. You're looking fabulous. It's good to be back, Ron. Yes. So every year, you know, these inventions are cooler and more interesting and more reasonable and more inspirational, and this year is a cool one.
Well, you know, I have to be honest with you. I ran down some of the winners, okay, and what they invented. And I have to tell you, I think our future is in great shape. Can I run down a couple of these? I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, this sixth grader from Houston, Texas, comprises a visual prosthesis that actually can help people with damage or deteriorating retinas. Now, how does that happen? You know, in sixth grade, I was trying to figure out how to use Velcro.
Well, we'll show you how to use Velcro. But we're here. I don't know if you got the story, but I'm in the studio with some people, some young people who have a vision enhancing system that they believe will come into existence in the next 20 years. And what's cool about the ExploraVision Awards is you have to work in teams. Mm-hmm. Right, everybody?
Yeah. Right.
So tell somebody start. Tell Ron what you got here.
Yeah, tell me.
Okay, my name is Joy Chen.
Hi, Joy.
And,
hi, Joy.
For our project, we created a bionic eye called BiSight. So basically, this eye is a visual prosthesis that allows people with damaged or deteriorating retinas to be able to see again. And it's made up of five main parts. There's an electrode array, two cameras, a silicon tube that everything goes into, and then a solar panel to power it.
Now,
so they're seniors. They're going to be seniors in high school. What were you doing when you were in high school, Ron?
I was trying to figure out that Velcro thing, Bill. took me a long time to figure that. In fact, I'm still not really straight on it. Now, what happens, Joy, when you're, you know, thinking about something to do? How do you come up even with the idea for this?
Oh, my name is Rima, and in our brainstorming process, we came up with a bunch of ideas, but we couldn't really settle with one. So we came up with a bionic eye, a bionic limb, a clear solar panels for cars, and a camera for blind people. Mm-hmm. So basically we just combined all these ideas and came up with our bionic eye.
The way you do, Ron.
Yeah, of course, just the way you do it. Like I do it every day, you know, Bill. Bill, do you have the person there that has the edible water bottle?
Yeah, but they're not in the studio. They're outside the studio. They're here the building at the press club in Washington, D.C.
The reason I ask that question is I just heard on the news a documentary the other day. It takes something like 1,000 or 2,000 years for a plastic water bottle to disintegrate. And they have one that not only doesn't disintegrate, you can eat.
Yeah, when you get around to it, yeah. But it has to hold water till it's time to eat. They worked that. They figured that out. So I predict that someday people will be mining our landfills. There's so much material in there.
Yeah. Now, what about the individual who has, or individuals, third graders now, who surgically inserted into damaged tissue to promote new cell growth? Now, that's another one, because that can help disorders like multiple sclerosis and ALS.
Oh, yeah, and then also any kind of injury. If you could use your own stem cells and get them to regenerate, like a lobster, to regenerate your own tissue, that would be fantastic. But I'm here, the people in the studio right now are high school kids who have this bionic eye that is very clever.
You know, I am very close friends with an eye doctor. He's my son's father-in-law. His mother, now a doctor.
His son's father-in-law, his mother, right?
Neighbors, aunts, uncles, next door neighbor.
There's an R in the month.
And there, and she has a detached retina. And here is a doctor, an eye doctor, and he can't do nothing about it. And here, a senior in high school has a cure.
That's right. You guys are going to fix the detached retina, right?
I think
not this weekend.
That would require a bit more work. Our project.
What's your name, man?
My name's Adi. Adi Editori, and our bionic eye uses the pieces of the functioning retina to allow a person with macular degeneration to see. So. A person with detached retina, unfortunately, would not be able to.
Oh, we'll figure that out.
We'll
if you get this working, we'll figure that out.
Yeah, yeah, that's the small stuff. Now you got.
Oh yeah.
Now my son is in law enforcement, so I was very interested in this magnesium infused bulletproof vest. I mean, that's another thing. You know, it's amazing, Bill, and I got to tell you this, and you and I have talked about this in the past. You have done something that I think is outstanding. You have been able to teach a subject that, for me at least, was very difficult in junior high school and senior high school, made it entertaining and fun and obviously effective to the youngsters. Because, you know, my extent of a science teacher that made something fun was Mr. Wizard. But you really make it happen. You know that, my friend?
That's our idea over here. We're just trying to change the world. You guys all grew up watching the Science Guy show, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Now, what gets me, Ron, these people are not old enough to have watched it when it was on originally. You were not born in the 1990s.
No.
Right?
But yeah, I was.
At the very end.
Just right at the end, yeah. But you weren't born in 1993, for example. So it was hard for you to watch it then.
I got a little piece in the library.
Yeah. But now people watch it in school. It's amazing. Exactly. It's crazy.
You know, Bill, what also amazes me about what you did is, you know, you're an engineer at Boeing. You designed horizontal stabilizer for the 747. You have all of this experience. And then at one point you went into being a stand-up comic. And, of course, you were able
gave
to...
Gave that a try, yes. Yeah. I gave it a try.
But you know what? You fused the science knowledge and the comedy, and you make it work. Now, how do these students apply next year? The people listening to our voices right now, if they have son, daughter, niece, nephew, the neighbor's aunt's brother's aunt, now, how do they apply to become part of 2017 Toshiba Explorer Vision?
You go to explorervision.org. And there's the rules and the how to apply and how to get it done. When did you guys start working on this project?
Oh, I'm Sarah Zhang. We started working around December.
Of this year, yeah.
Well, last year.
No, of last year, I mean of this school year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it takes months to get these ideas together. You have to create a website. You have to show that it's doable. And then it's judged by the National Science Teachers Association. So the sooner you get started, the better.
Well, now, wait a minute, Bill.
So if you're out there, you're looking for fun this summer, get started on your Explorer Vision idea.
Now you're actually saying to me, the student there, that you started this prosthesis eye in December, or you started the process to be into the contest?
Yeah, it was around December.
Both.
Normally, it would start earlier, but people tend to procrastinate, even though it's due, in the beginning of January. So we just worked on it during winter break. That's it was fine.
You know, Bill, you're absolutely so lucky
to
be part of this.
Yeah, what were you doing during your winter break?
Well, trying to do that Velcro thing again, Bill.
You're still working on that.
Still working. That took me a long time to get that thing handled. It really did. But I'm glad I finally got it. I bought a tie shoe. You know, it was just a lot easier. But the 2016 Toshiba Explorer Vision winners with Bill Nye, the Science Guy, and you are now at the National Press Club as we speak in your nearby home of Washington, D.C., right?
Yes. We're doing all that. And tonight's a big banquet. We give out awards. It's very exciting.
That's great.
Very gratifying.
Bill, one of these days I want to bring you back at your convenience, and I want to talk about some of the other things you've done in your life, including, and this fascinates me, the Cannonball 300, all right, where you did 300 miles in one day on a bicycle. We need to talk.
Yeah, you can see I'm fine now, but back when I was crazy, yes.
Well,
I used to spend a lot of time on a bicycle.
Yes. Well, please tell the students that I congratulate them. They are absolutely...
They can hear you. We got this all it's all electronic here.
I want to tell you, I'm very proud of everything that you've done. You are the future. Please don't be discouraged by any setbacks, because we need you to make this world better. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks,
Thank
Bill.
You.
Okay, thanks, guys. Thanks, Bill. I'll
look forward. On.
And that's the man, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. A fascinating story he has, though, because here's a fellow that at one point said, hey, you know what, I'm going to be an engineer. And he became an engineer at Boeing and developed things for the 747, then decided to be a stand-up comedian, and then becomes a 7-time National Emmy Award-winning host of several long-running science shows. Bill Nye, the Science Guy, talking about the 2016 Toshiba Explorer Vision winners at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And there's more to come with Ron Segi today. It's Ron Segi, live all across the USA and around the world. If it's trending, it's right here. You talk about somebody who can really pump the soul into you, because she's had some experiences over her life that never held her back. She is going to be talking about some summer fun ideas, who not only is a New York Times bestselling author with her autobiography, but her story was told in the popular film Soul Surfer. Joining us right now is our guest, Bethany Hamilton. Hi, Bethany. How are you?
Aloha. Thank you for having me.
You're not in Hawaii right now, are you, dear?
I'm not in Hawaii. I'm in California. I just finished an awesome weekend with my family at a Hampton by Hilton in Hermosa Beach, and it was awesome.
Yeah, I'm envious of you. Before we talk about some of the things we want to talk about today, I'd like to just recap for those who may not know, and I don't know why they wouldn't, your story. At 13 years old, you lost your arm to a 14-foot tiger shark, and that seemed to just dispel the fact that you were ever going to become a surfing star. 1 month after the attack, you returned to the water. Within 2 years, you won the first national title. Back in 2007, you realized the dream of being a New York Times bestselling autobiography writer, and then the film Soul Surfer, which is the story of your career. What was it like at 13 years old to see your dream, what you thought would be eliminated, but because of your perseverance, was not?
Yeah, I look back on that time and, yeah, I felt like my dreams had been taken away from me, but I also was just thankful just to be alive. And then slowly but surely, my kind of hint of inspiration to get back in the ocean came, and less than a month later, I was back out there doing what I love to do and kind of adapting to life with one arm and adapting to surfing with one arm. Yeah, I attribute much of my success to my family and my faith in God, who have been so supportive along the way and encouraged me to be the best I can be.
Now, you know, Bethany, a lot of people will tell other individuals that you can't do something. Were there people that said to you, why are you trying to do this? Because, you know, you are now, left with a, and I use this word very loosely, a slight handicap.
Yeah, I mean, I think people definitely thought it. They may not have said it to me. And even my mom, she was so loving and encouraging. But at the time, she was like, well, maybe we could try something else besides surfing. And just kept trying to come up with a new normal for me. And, you know, I think once she saw me going for it and getting back out there, then she became my biggest cheerleader, and along with my dad, too, who was there for me every step of the way. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people thought, like, no way she could do that. But, yeah, it's pretty cool that I was able to adapt and continue chasing my dreams. And now today I'm still continuing a professional surfing career, and I love what I do, and I love being in the ocean and love surfing.
How cool is that? The term soul surfer, actually, and I remember this because I was around at this time, was actually something that was coined in the early 60s as someone who doesn't compete, just likes to go out there for pleasure. But your dad thought that would be a great name for the book and ultimately for the movie. And I think that really hit. Soul surfer is really a good name.
Yeah, I think to me, like, a soul surfer is someone who just doesn't let roadblocks keep them from getting back in the ocean and doing what they love to do. And, you know, for me, I could have easily just, like, let surfing go and continued life in a different direction, and that I continue to just passionately surf and still do today.
Now, here you are, a worldwide champion surfer. You live in the, you know, one of the most beautiful places in the entire world, and you're now in California on, like, a Seekender, if you will. Now, tell us why it is so important when you're traveling to have the spontaneity of the moment. You talk about this many times, about recommendations of, you know, planning a weekend getaway. I've traveled a lot, but, you know, sometimes they say, well, why don't you try the staycation idea of staying at home? It's a great idea, but you end up painting the fence, you end up cutting the grass. You know, you just got to get away, don't you?
Yeah, as much as I love being home, I love getting on the road and, you know, especially with my family, creating new lifelong memories as we just adventure and explore. And recently, my husband and son and I, we just had a stay at Hampton by Hilton in Hermosa Beach. And rather than planning a jam-packed agenda, we just planned, like, fun activities that we really wanted to do. And then we left the weekend open to just spontaneity. And we stumbled on this rad little, like, art show and just had a great time, like, letting go everything at home, all our stresses, and just enjoyed each other and had a great time.
I like the idea that you say how to create a non-agenda. That is a lot harder than what it appears to be.
Yeah, it is. So often, like, in the past even, I know that I have the tendency to, like, try to put too much in a short window of time. And especially now as a mom, like, that does not work. You can't overplan, no. And it ends up becoming stressful. So, yeah, I definitely encourage everyone to, like, hey, like, just plan the one major thing that you want to do in the weekend, and then leave the weekend been to exploring, adventuring, and exposing yourself to new experiences and just being a seekender.
Now, what do you like to do? I mean, now you're obviously on the beach right now, and that's where you spend a great deal of your business. That's your kind of your office, if you will. But other than the beach, where do you like to go? Where does Bethany like to go?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not at the beach, I still love to be outdoors. So finding places with, like, great outdoor adventure and, like, going on hikes. Even recently, we went to South Dakota and went to Mount Rushmore, which was awesome.
Oh.
And the place had so many things to do. I wish we had had, like, 4 weekends there because it would have been, like, nonstop adventure.
I've been in every place in this country, everywhere, okay? And all I want to do is go to Mount Rushmore. That's, you know, that is at the top of my list of what I want to do. So I'm so glad you said that because that
is... Oh, yeah, get out there and do it. It's awesome. It's so beautiful there.
Well, Bethany, where can we go for more information about Seekender?
Just visit hamptonseekender.com and, yeah, leave room for spontaneity.
Well, Bethany, thank you so much for joining us. And if you ever decide you want to surf off the shores of Florida, come on down and I can... watch you, okay?
Awesome. Yeah, I always am heading on down to Florida. That's one of our favorite places to go.
Well, let me know when you're here, okay, dear?
Okay, God bless.
Thanks, Bethany. Our guest has been one truly incentive for people. I mean, what an inspiration she is. At the age of 13, losing an arm to a shark and then going on to be one of the great surfers of all time. And the star of her story being in film with Soul Surfer. We're talking about Bethany Hamilton. And there's more to come live all across the U.S. and around the world with Ron Sedgy today. On this Father's Day weekend, that's a wrap with Ron Sedgy today. Want to thank everyone for listening, and I want to thank our guests for being part of this weekend. And they include actor David Duchovny, baseball-turned-singing star Mike Studd, from Lost History, Brad Melzer, champion golfer Jim Furyk, actor Robert Forrester, star of London Has Fallen, actor Hill Harper, Bill Nye, the Science Guy, and Bethany Hamilton. Hope all the dads out there are getting their phone calls from their children, and if their dad is not with you, please remember your pop on this very special weekend, Father's Day. That's going to wrap it up for today. Till next week, I'm Ron Sedgy, hoping that you have blue skies and green lights.